Hello and welcome to Seafar Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
Seafar Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At Seafar, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
Before we get started with the main part of the show, it's time for a construction update. During our last construction update, we were in the process of wrapping up phase one. The pole barn had been put in place, and the roads recently finished. The summer has been hot, but that has not slowed down our progress. We've been working to finalize our initial enclosure design. This multi-week process required our most skilled and experienced staff to put all the lessons learned into one cohesive package. The result of those designs were then discussed with our two regulatory agencies, Florida Fish and Wildlife and the United States Department of Agriculture. While that process continued, we completed installation of our well pumps and protective sheds to go over them. A scheduled prescribed burn on surrounding properties took place. This not only allows for natural land clearing, but will mitigate the risk of significant wildfire for about 3 years. Installation of our three-phase electrical service is now complete, and we are in permitting to begin running conduit to the various hubs around the facility and for the construction of our first enclosure. Crews are on site making sure that the land stays clear and that we are prepared for the next phases of construction. Stay tuned for more updates and visit our website at cflar.org. That's cflar.org. Click on the news section for the latest updates on the build. And now, part two of our legislative roundup and discussion about the Big Cat Bill, H.R. 1998.
Well, that in itself is the question, is that the people that do have big cats, are they doing what they can to give them the best quality of life that they can?
I think I also have to caveat that to say that we are a public charity that is also publicly known. Not all the wildlife sanctuaries that are out there are publicly known. Many of them choose to stay out of the spotlight. They choose to stay out of the conversation that's going on, because what tends to happen is whenever you stick your head up, there's someone who's out there sniping or trying to take it off. It's a lot easier when you're dealing with animals that it's very difficult to make connections with people unless they feel like they can come and touch and see and whatnot. It's very difficult to have a conversation of any depth with people who are still looking at this as a bunch of pretty kitties or as a bunch of persecuted cats. And that's what happens when you put yourself out there and you say, listen, this is what we do. We exist. We'd like you to help. And so what happens to us is, you know, we end up being asked these questions on behalf of the industry. And unfortunately, we can't speak for the entire industry. But yet, when people think of the industry, when people who are unaffiliated think of the industry, they'll look to us for leadership. They'll look to us for our impressions because they know of us. That awkward position of being the unintentional experts does come with it a certain amount of pressure to make sure that we do continue to do what we want to have done for the cats. But it does continue to drive other individuals and other groups into the shadows because they either can't or are unwilling to accept the public nature of that responsibility.
But still, it comes down to, there is still a line which you can draw that we've already talked about, that you can say that a big cat is not being taken care of to a condition that would be acceptable. I'm sure that the USDA, when they do come and look at the sanctuaries, do have some level of determining that kind of thing?
There are some numbers here and there. You know, there have to be a certain legal size for enclosures for a certain number of animals. There have to be certain heights of walls if there are certain types of enclosures. But a lot of USDA's rules are based on performance standards. And this concept of the performance standard is basically, they say, you've got to build an enclosure that an animal cannot escape out of. They may not tell you how. They may not tell you with the exact materials. They won't prescribe exactly what needs to be done. However, if you put an animal in that enclosure and that animal escapes, then you have not met the performance standard.
But on the contrary, if you put the animal in the enclosure and it's your house and the animal does not escape, you have met the performance standard.
Conceptually, you know, there's other bits and pieces. Like, for example, there may be something that says that the animal may have to have access to natural substrate or access to free water access. And that is how people can end up having big cats in their house, because you can build your home in such a way that it is an inescapable place for a big cat, except the fact that you've got a tiger in your living room, which is not necessarily a great idea.
Well, we did talk about in a previous episode comparing big cats to little cats that, you know, having a pet around does lower your blood pressure.
However, seeing as how tigers are definitely not pets, you know, then that's probably not going to lower your blood pressure. I don't think that we're ever going to get rid of that piece of programming in our bodies, thank goodness, that says, this is something I should be running from.
Right, that's always going to be there.
Right, at least I hope it will always be there.
Well, in some cases, that's what keeps you safe and the volunteers that work with the big cats.
Exactly. And everyone deals with fear in a different way. Some people will deal with fear in the way that it needs to be mitigated. It needs to be removed. Those are the people that are basically saying that since we can never guarantee that big cats are safe, we're going to need to just get rid of all of them. They don't belong here. They belong in the wild. And therefore, the only safe thing for us to do is to eliminate them. I'm sure that that kind of thinking did a great job with making sure that the bald eagle was almost extinct, the red wolf, and now the bison even. That's extinction thinking. I'm afraid of it, so let's just get rid of it. There's another school of thought that says, if I'm afraid of it, I need to conquer it. And that's where you end up with some of these giant egos, beastmaster egos, that say, well, if everybody's afraid of it, the fact that I'm not afraid and can show you that I'm not afraid somehow makes me better. That's another extreme that is extremely dangerous. And then there are the other parts of it, the parts that move society forward, where we say, you know what, we're afraid of this, so let's look at this. Let's figure this out. Let's work together as a species to do what humans do, which is synthesize novel solutions out of the data that we're given, to find out how we can mitigate those elements that are causing us fear. If cats are dangerous, then we need to be able to put appropriate barriers up. Doesn't mean that we need to try and remove them from our existence. It just means that we need to acknowledge that there's a risk with certain types of proximity and do something about it. Same thing with, you know, the risk of trying to make sure that we don't contribute to this international trade. This is one element of it, certainly, but it can't just be a unilateral thing. Let's go after just the cats. We need to beef up customs. We need to help those countries that have these trades and where the money is really being exchanged for these animals find ways that they can improve their law enforcement while making sure that everyone in our country recognizes the impact on how this has on our national security. It may be a bit roundabout, but we do need to notify all of the parties of what they're going to do.
It's interesting because one of the other things I had seen statements on a website, I've seen it more than one place too, is that it's easier to buy a big cat in some cases than it is to get ownership or adopt a dog from some of the different organizations.
In the toughest adoption environments is going to be tougher, almost as hard to adopt an animal as it is to adopt a child, a human child. Because there can be some amazing, amazing barriers that can be put up in there. But by the same token, you know, the accessibility to getting domesticated creatures, whether it be a puppy or a kitten, that accessibility makes it easier to get one of them than it is to get a tiger. You could drive out from your home, and within a few leaps, you can probably find a pet store. It is highly unlikely that that pet store is going to have a tiger. It's going to have a lion. What they're referencing is that those who do the breeding and those who are interested in purchase of those animals have limited resources. There are limited markets, and everyone who wants that knows where those markets are. So that's where the ease comes in.
So to them, at least for those people in those markets, those in the know, so to speak, it is somewhat easy for them to get a big cat.
Sure. Just like for people who are in the know about any subculture, whether it be comics or video games or other pieces like that, if you know where to go, then it's very easy to obtain that which you're looking for.
Well, another piece of this legislation, or at least another premises of why the legislation has been put forth, is because there's some kind of idea that the big cats in captivity are not helping at all for conservation, and in some cases are actually deterring efforts of conservation.
This is, again, the double-edged sword. I unfortunately fall somewhat in the middle of how this kind of works, because on the one extreme, you're right. If somebody has $1,000 that they're going to give to help a big cat, you know, that they wake up one morning, they say, I want to help a tiger. It is highly more likely that they are going to give that money to something that they can see versus something that they have to conceptualize. All of the work that World Wildlife Fund does, that a lot of these other NGOs and groups do in the native lands, which is, you know, India, China, in Siberia, that money disappears. It goes out there, and the only way that anybody knows that there's any efficacy is when they eventually report back that we have quote-unquote more tigers. It's very difficult to get an independent assessment on how well their money is being spent. However, if you give your money to a local sanctuary that is trying to take care of big cats right in your approximate area, then you have the ability to go over and check up on that tiger every once in a while and say, yep, tiger still looks good. Everything still looks good. I made the right choice. We aren't silly consumers. It's very difficult to get money to do something that people aren't going to be able to have a tangible thing to see what their impact is. And so I can see the conservation community having a severe gripe with the idea that a sanctuary is going to get that money that they really could use because, you know, they're passionate about what they do too, and what they do is very important for the wild. But if those resources are being sucked up inside the country, it becomes very difficult to continue the work necessary to keep the cats where they belong. Now, that being said, you've got the other side where we are a very materialistic, consumeristic, voyeuristic society, whichever istic you'd like to put on there. And if we can't see it, touch it, then it doesn't have value. And it's a lot easier to convince somebody with a cute tiger cub that is right in front of them versus the concept of saving a tiger cub that they can't ever pet, touch, see, interact with.
Obviously, the fact that we have tigers on display, either at sanctuaries or at zoos, lions, tigers, big cats in general, it gives people the ability to conceptualize the fact that these animals are majestic, wonderful creatures and could actually spur them to give money to these conservation efforts for saving them in the wild. So there is a double-edged sword to that.
Yes, if the organization eventually gets to the point where they are able to pass that through. Something that is talked about in the sanctuary community, you know, conservation is a part of a lot of organizations' mottos and a lot of organizations' marketing. But what is really being done about conservation at these organizations? Ideally, a sanctuary should be able to draw people towards the plight of the cats as a proxy for the plight of a cat in the wild. So at a certain point, all of the organizations should be required to do something that is going to benefit the populations in the lands that they belong. But if that money gets locked up in taking care of the cats on site, or in some cases gets locked up in paying salaries and people to try and, you know, help people just make a living on the ground, then it never trickles out from the sanctuary to the places where the cats are actually at. And that's more of a business problem than it is a problem of the sanctuary model. It's very expensive. The United States is a very expensive country in some ways, and it can be very expensive to both maintain a facility to the level to which people are going to come to, and then have to give resources off to other organizations, the results of which we may not ever actually see. That being said, it's extremely important that the conservation message not be used as a money gathering tool, but it's something that is used to actually assist in the process of conserving out in the wild.
Well, one of the other arguments to the conservation issue is that the tigers that are in captivity are not purebred. So they're not adding to the gene pool, so to speak, of conservation efforts.
Well, if I were, you know, I talk about the CNN rule occasionally. If I had CNN that busted in and stuck a camera in my face and said, okay, you're on national news, explain to me why you think that it's okay to have these tigers that aren't contributing to the gene pool still around, I would make a couple of points. I would feel very comfortable looking at the camera and saying, these are living beings. They deserve the rights that come with being a living being, which is a chance at life. Now, that chance has been taken away through no fault of their own and through no fault of my own or the people that are around us. In fact, no one who's alive today is at fault for the fact that tigers are in captivity today. And I think that point is often lost, that tigers have been captive in this country for many, many generations, going all the way back to the Wild West of when people used to go and take safari and just bring an animal back with them. Captive populations of big exotic animals have existed in this country for generations. And now, suddenly, the fact that these generational cats that have been part of our society quietly for all these years is being brought to the forefront is requiring us to develop new language and new patterns of thought on how to deal with it, because it's not a new problem. This is an established problem that's as old and as ingrained as any other cultural institution that is part of this country. And by us taking the step of bringing this out in public and giving people the opportunity to see what's behind the veil, so to speak, is not only an essential public service, but is going to be mandatory if we're ever going to come to a satisfactory conclusion to the issue of animals in captivity.
Well, obviously, the tigers and lions and such that are in captivity here in the U.S., they're not intended to be released back into the wild in any case. And the fact that they're not purebred really is of no consequence in that regard. Like you say, they're beings. They're cats. They are what they are. We're taking care of them because they're alive, because they deserve it.
I have to wonder whether or not in the early days of when the dog was trying to be domesticated from the wolf, whether there was a big debate on whether or not we should be dealing with these wild creatures that are only a few degrees separated from being out there.
There probably was some debate, but it was long enough ago. And a lot of that actually happened in a time period when people were nomadic and the wolves were following them around and taking scraps and became pets, sort of. And that's kind of how that began. Obviously, at that point in time, having a big cat as a pet wasn't necessarily a good idea.
No, the cats could prey on them, but then so could wolves. But at some point in the past, some very wise or perhaps even foolhardy individuals figured that they might be able to find something out by being that close to a creature that's wild. And something amazing happens in nature once two species start to communicate. that's really where we're at now. We're kind of in a frontier where we are learning to communicate in different ways. And every day reminding ourselves about the nature of power and that power in nature. And it's something that we have managed to remove ourselves from as a society in amazing ways, to the point now where we don't even have to talk to people anymore. We can text them. We can buy things online, have it delivered. You don't have to engage the world. And tigers are a very tangible representation of a very powerful world that we are part of and that we can't forget. We can't forget that we're part of.
Another part of that conservation issue, of course, is the fact that these animals that are in captivity are being studied in a way. We obviously have to know how to best take care of them, how they think, what they do, what they need. Some of that can be transferred knowledge for the people that are trying to conserve them in the wild.
We've talked about this in the past, too, that appropriate communication between the people who are in captive situations and people who are in wild situations is essential for helping translate some of the behaviors that people are seeing in the wild. Wild observers are very restricted in how much they can interact with the animals that they deal with. Very restricted. They can't just walk into a pride. They can't just walk into a tiger's den and watch them, not just for maintaining their natural environment, but also for maintaining the scientific objectivity. They have to be a little bit removed, which means they're going to see things that, from an action standpoint, may be completely misconstrued, except that those people who have perhaps by proxy been part of those societies, whether it be a pride or a group of tigers, can say, oh, well, yes, the tiger, that I've been working with since they were young has done this to me, and this is what it seems to mean. And that perspective allows sometimes the neutral observer to have a little bit more knowledge in terms of what it is that they're looking at.
So clearly there are some benefits to zoos and sanctuaries and such for the conservation efforts.
And only the most extreme would argue that there's no benefit. The challenge is really that of a human challenge. We have very strong political opinions on both sides. And in terms of advancing the dialogue and trying to move the industry in a direction that makes it worthy of respect, the people who have perhaps gotten the chance to evolve a little bit more in the industry necessarily deal with a lot of frustration, because it's possible to have been doing this for 10, 20 years and still have someone tell you something like the lion's the one with the stripes and the female tiger is the one with the mane.
Because, who says that?
Well, you'd be surprised. People... Big cats are not a part of people's lives here. It's just not something that is thought of outside of entertainment or outside of the movies or things like that. So there is an acknowledgement of big cats, and there are lots of animal lovers, but it's one thing to be in just an animal lover, and it's another thing to actually understand animal issues. And getting to that level of discussion is part of the challenge that we have to continue to fight and continue to make known. It's one of our major educational tenets, is giving people the chance to develop that conversational technique so that they can have responsible conversations about this.
Incidentally, I went to one of those websites that does kind of like surveys. They actually did a survey on this particular bill on HR 1998. And in the general public, 83% were for it and 17% were against it. And if you look at the people that are for it and the people that are against it, there's a lot of big organizations that are supporting this particular bill. There's no organizations that have signed up as opposing it. But the people that are opposing it on the basis that there are already many laws out there to protect animal welfare, and they are not being enforced to the level that they should be. So just having another law on the books is not going to make it any better.
Yes, it's again the classic story of politics in the United States. You've got those that say, why don't we make what we have work? And then you've got those that say, what we have is not working, let's try something else. And you can see this debate almost in every bill, in every major issue that you hear about on the news. It's that intersection between states' rights and what the federal government can do. It's that intersection between a laissez-faire, hands-off approach to business, trying to figure things out in the free market versus government intervention. It's that discussion between you've got to do what's right for you versus you've got to do what's right for everyone. And in that regard, big cats are part of the very fabric of what makes this country so interesting and great. It's part of that debate where we are trying to follow that magical Goldilocks rule of just right, as opposed to going too extreme to either side.
Well, if you're interested in tracking how this bill is doing, govtrack.us actually allows you to track anything that's going through Congress at this point. And again, the bill is H.R. 1998. Govtrack.us has only given this bill an 11% chance of actually getting passed. They have many different criteria as to how they determine that. One of them being that it is unfortunate as it is, there's actually been only 3% of bills that have been presented that have passed in the past couple of years. So that in itself is one of the reasons why most bills don't get passed, is because statistically it just hasn't worked out that way. But you can use these websites and other kinds of things like that to learn more about these bills and become educated and be more knowledgeable as a citizen.
Certainly, stay tuned. We're going to have more discussion about some of the issues that surround these bills and surround big cats in general. It's very important that everyone who's listening is aware and gets into the discussion. Because at the end of the day, it's not about what the people are going to do inside of our insular society. It's about what we as humans need to do to be appropriate stewards for the creatures that are under our care.
CFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wills. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding.